You know, as we read through the Bible and study what God has given us, we see that there are a lot of different agricultural references in there, aren't there? The holy days, the feast, are centered around the harvest times. Jesus told a lot of parables that have farming imagery. And there are various other verses in there that refer to various things concerning agriculture and farming. And if we want to understand these references a little better, to get a better understanding of what God is trying to teach us, it would be good to understand the basis on which they're given, to understand what the agricultural year is like in Israel. Because here in an urban area, a lot of us probably don't have any experience with farming whatsoever. And even those of us who do have some experience with that in our past, it's in a different climate. We have four seasons here in the Midwest. You know, we have certain crops and times we do things. But still, that's different than what it's like in Israel. So today what I'd like to do is just to go over what the agricultural year is, the Bible farming year is, so that we have a basis from on which we can draw, so that as we read these parables, as we think about the feast in terms of how they relate to agriculture, we'll have a better understanding, and hopefully we'll be able to have a fuller understanding of what God is trying to teach us. So the agriculture year does not line up exactly with what the year does anyway. We know that the first month of the year is in the springtime. But the agricultural year actually starts in the fall after the Feast of Tabernacles is over in the last great day. And it starts with rainfall. Now, let me take an aside here a little bit to talk about rainfall, because we take that for granted, don't we? We have our seasons where we get our rain, and we usually have enough of it. We have some years where we have too much, some years where we have not enough. But generally speaking, we take it for granted that we're going to get the rainfall. But in Israel, there are two seasons. There's the wet season, and then there's the dry season. Each lasts about 6 months long. And rainfall is absolutely critical for the land of Israel in order for the agriculture to prosper. Let's take a look at what God told the Israelites as they were getting ready to enter the promised land. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verses 10 and 12. We'll start there. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 10 and 12. This is a different environment that the Israelites were going into. Their parents had lived for decades in Egypt, and this generation had wandered around in the desert wilderness. So let's see what God tells them here. Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 10. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. So we see, he's telling them, your land depends on rain. I don't know how many of you have been to the Field Museum. It's been a while since we've been there. But they have their Egypt display in there. And there's one spot where they show you the mechanism that the Egyptians used to take the water from the canals and from the river and then to carry it over and dump it onto their irrigation ditches. They watered by foot. They didn't have rain. They only had the Nile. Not so in the Promised Land. They had rain. And that rain was needed to moisten the soil. It was needed to replenish the different pools and the streams, because there were really no major rivers in Israel. Now, you had the Jordan, which was over on the eastern border, but within the main area of Israel itself, there were no other major rivers. They relied on the pools and the streams. They had to have the rain to replenish those, and they had to have the rain to water the land. It was also well understood by the Israelites, and we see in numerous verses in the Bible, that rain wasn't just happenstance. God was in control of the rain. Now, of course, the modern-day science way of thinking, well, no, that doesn't make sense because things just happen because the climate is the way it is and so forth. Well, yes, it is. But who created the climate? Who created the planet? The rain is as a result of God's action, and because he was his creator, there were times when he needed to get a message across to the people, and he used rain to do that. Since we're here in Deuteronomy 11, let's go ahead and continue in verses 13 through 17. Deuteronomy 11, verses 13. And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. Clearly, God had control of the rain. He would send the rain, he would send it in season when they're following, but when they refused to obey God, he reserved the right to withhold that rain. And because Israel didn't have a lot of rivers, they would quickly suffer the consequences of that. So understanding the importance of rain, let's start in here and talk about what are some of the major events, major key points in the agricultural year. Well, as I said, the agricultural year starts with rain. Towards the end of the seventh month, the prevailing winds start to shift around again and start coming out of a westerly direction. Now, remember your geography. What's west of Israel? It's the Mediterranean Sea. So as those winds start to come across the sea, they pick up the moisture. And as they come across Israel, they start dropping the rain. This usually starts late October, early November. And the amount of rain and the frequency slowly starts to increase as the weeks pass. This is the start of the rainy season, which I said lasts for about 6 months. And once this rain starts, typically speaking, you will not have any period of prolonged days of fair weather. There will always be rain within a few days of each other. It's not constantly raining, but you won't have like a week full of sunshine. There is going to be rain. But this early rain is essential for a couple of reasons. One, keep in mind, it's been 6 months since they've had rain. The soil is dry and it's hard. There's not really much you can do with it. So the rain is critical to start softening up the soil so that the farmers can work with it. And as that soil starts being softened, the rain is a signal to them, we need to start plowing the fields. So let's take a look at that, a reference to that, how important this rain is, the early rains, in Psalm 65. Psalm 65 and verses 9 and 10. The psalmist here is speaking to God. Verse 9, you visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its ridges abundantly. You settle its furrows. You make it soft with showers. You bless its growth. These are all the results of the beginning of those early rains. And as you read through the Bible, you'll see references to the early rains or the former rains. This is what it's talking about. These first rains that start to come down in the fall that soften up the soil and make it so that it can be worked, so that it can be plowed. So the next step in the agriculture year is actually planting the grain. Now, there's two things that are involved here. We've already referred to one of them, and that's plowing. The ground is hard and flat. Now it's starting to get softened up, but you still have to go up and till up the soil a little bit so that the seed will have a place to rest and to take root. So before you can plant, you have to plow. Now, the type of plow that they had was very primitive compared to what we might be used to seeing today. Effectively, you had a couple beams that were hooked together, and the front part of these beams would hook to the yoke of the oxen, and the back part would connect to a long pole. On one end of this pole, basically it was a sharp point that had metal wrapped around it, and on the other end was a little cross piece, just a little handle. So as we heard earlier today in Luke, when Jesus said, "He who puts his hand to the plow," that's literally what you would do. You would put a hand to that plow, and you're using your hand to guide and put some pressure on this pole to keep the pointed part down in the soil. The plow, you know, again, we think about today's equipment and where you got the plowshares and they just turn the soil over. This plow would not do that. Compared to what our plows do today, it would really do nothing more than just scratch the surface. It would barely dig in just an inch or two, enough to loosen up the soil to make a place for the seed. And this cross piece would make, it would just take a lot of effort. You know, it's not something that you could casually do. You'd have to forcefully put there. And because it's designed the way it was, this long pole, it would be easy to convert that plowshare into a sword, or the other way around. And Isaiah remarks about that, Isaiah 2:4, let me just read that to you. You're probably familiar with it. "He shall judge between nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." Micah says pretty much a very similar statement in Micah 4:3, whereas in Joel 3:10, we actually see the reverse of that, where they would beat their plowshares into swords. But it was because of the shape of this plowshare, and it's a pole with a sharp pointy end, is why it would be so easily converted from an implement of agriculture to an implement of war. But in addition to the plow, the farmer also would hold in his other hand a goad. And this was basically a long, hard, sturdy, pointed stick, because he would have to keep the oxen moving in the right direction. So if they'd want to stop and kind of look around or didn't feel like pulling anymore, you'd have to kind of poke them with this sharp stick. And imagine the difficulty of that. You've got this goat in one hand you're holding, and you're trying to hold the plow down here. It's not a casual endeavor. It's hard work. And you can't look back, because then your plow is going to just go all over the place. Now, we also have a reference to this goad, this long, sharp stick, in Acts 9:5. In Acts 9:5, if you're familiar with that, this is when Paul was on his way to Damascus. And he sees the bright flash of light, he's blind and stuff like that. And as he's carrying on this conversation, in Acts 9:5, he says, "And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?' Then the Lord said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goads.'" This is what he's talking about. He's talking about this goad that was used in plowing, because the goad was used to move the oxen in a particular direction. And if the oxen didn't like it, if they kicked, which is a natural response, it's going to be painful. And they very soon would learn that, no, you can't do that. They just keep going in the direction that you're being directed. This is the same thing that Paul had to deal with. Jesus wanted him to go in a particular direction, and he didn't want to. So he's kind of kicking against it, but it was painful. Finally got to the point where he realized he can't kick against these goads anymore. He needs to go in the direction that Jesus Christ has set him to go. So this is what we see in terms of plowing. Carrying the goad, strenuously keeping the plow in place as we're plowing. Well, once the plowing was done, then they'd go through and start to do the sowing. Now, they would, in the fall of the year, you'd plant both the barley and the wheat. They had different growing seasons, so they mature at different times, as we'll see later. But pretty much you plant them about the same time. Now, again, the way they would plant that is they would have sacks of grain. They'd carry that out with a mule or something, and then they'd divide it up into smaller sacks. And as they're planting, they'd scoop their hand into the sack and do what's called broadcast sowing. You know, they just throw it in different areas of the field. Maybe if you've ever done any grass seeding or something like that in your lawns, you've done a similar type of thing. It's not where you don't have a machine that's putting it down into rows in a specific area. You're just casting it about. Well, we see references to that too, as they would be throwing the seed around in their field. There's some unusual things which we might not expect today, but were fairly commonplace in the fields of that time. First thing is that they had roads going through their fields. Now you might think, what? Especially if you think about our roads, you know, like 294 is what, 6 lanes, 7 lanes. That's going through a field. There's not even a field there. Well, the road, and I use that word loosely, that would go through the field was really nothing more than a footpath. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. We see an example of this. Luke chapter 6 and verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples picked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Now Jesus and his disciples weren't just out casually meandering out in the middle of a wheat field. They were actually on a road. You see, there really were very few major roads to speak of in Israel until the Romans came. The Romans were great at engineering things, and in order to move their armies, they made sure that they built roads. So the Romans built major roads. But prior to this, when people would travel, usually it was on foot or on the back of a donkey or mule or something like that, there really were just well-worn footpaths that they would use. And many times, these footpaths would end up going through a middle field. Now, if you're familiar with the parable of the sower that Jesus gave in Matthew 13, and Mark and Luke also record that, he talks about as the farmer was out seeding his field, some of the seed fell on the wayside. Well, this is what he's talking about. He's talking about this footpath that goes through the field. And because it is well-traveled, it's going to be hard, it's going to be packed down, and the farmer isn't even going to bother to try to plow that. But his field comes right up to it. And so he's going to be casting seed into the field, and some of it's going to go a little long, and it's going to end up on the wayside. But because it hasn't been plowed, that seed has no place where it can take root. So that's one unusual thing that we might need to be aware of, is that there were roads, so to speak, there were traveling paths that would go through the fields. The second thing is, there are thorns out there. Now you might think, why, you know, the farmer's out here, he's plowing. Why is he leaving thorns in his field? It doesn't seem to make sense. We want to get rid of those weeds. They compete with everything else. Well, again, in the parable of the sower, Jesus is talking that as the farmer is casting the seed about, some of the seed falls among the thorns. Well, these were actually thorn bushes. They weren't just thistles like we have around here. They were thorn bushes, and they were kind of woody. But they were left on the outer edges of the field. Now, why would you do that? Why would you leave these big thorn bushes on the edge of your field? Well, later on in the year, when the weather's better, and you're out there with your livestock and you're staying overnight and stuff like that, these thorns were cut down and used as fuel for the fires to cook their meals. So he didn't want to just get rid of them. They were used eventually. But you had to make sure that when you did set the fire, that the fire didn't spread. I won't turn there, but in Exodus 22:6, it says, "A fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed. He who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution." They would use these thorns to build their fires, because there wasn't always a whole lot of wood available. But when you got woody weeds and plants like that, you can use that instead. So, after the plowing is done, and after the seed is planted, now we're starting to get into winter. Planting's done, the livestock is brought in, because this is when the heavy rains start. See, what happens is there are rain systems that start moving in from the north. But the problem is there are tropical high-pressure systems that sit in Africa. So these rain systems come here, and all of a sudden they can't move. They're blocked by the high-pressure systems in Africa. So they just sit there, and they rain and rain and rain. Sometimes 2, 3, 4 days in a row, cold, wet rain. Frequently, it's only in the 40s. Or like this year, if you remember the news reports recently, the temperatures were cold enough that even Jerusalem had over a foot of snow. This is part of the systems that come in with the heavy, wet rain. You bring your livestock in because you don't want your sheep sitting out in cold, wet rain day after day after day. And to keep it contemporary with what's going on this week, your sheep aren't going to be out in the middle of December waiting for angels to appear. They're not out there. The shepherds aren't out there either. It's cold. It's wet. This heavy rain starts in mid-December, and it usually lasts into late January, maybe early February. But they have to have this rain. These rains provide the primary moisture for the growth of the grain that was just planted. If it didn't have these rains, it didn't have that moisture, the grain wouldn't grow. It wouldn't develop. In addition to providing the moisture in the fields for the grain, these rains replenished the pools and the streams and made it so that there would be water available throughout the rest of the year. I say these rains last until probably about early February, and then they start to taper off. And then we get to the third division of the rainy season, which are called the latter rains. And you'll see a number of verses in the Bible which refer to the latter rains. These latter rains usually fall around March. They're not as heavy as what the winter rains are, but they're still very important. Because as you start to get into mid-late March, the barley is now to the point where it's just about ready and starting to mature. And without this extra moisture, those heads of barley grains aren't going to reach full maturity. Likewise with the wheat. The wheat needs this rain, because if it doesn't have this rain at all, then it's not going to have enough moisture in the soil to get it to its full maturity, because it matures about a month after the barley does. So these latter rains are still very critical for the maturity, the maturation of the barley and the wheat later on. So now that brings us to the grain harvest. As we know, the days of unleavened bread, during the days of unleavened bread, we have our wave sheaf harvest. And this is the signal for the farmers to begin to be able to start to harvest the barley. So that starts in the first month of the year. Now, both the barley and the wheat, while not harvested at the same time, they're consecutive. So both of them are called the first fruits, even though they're harvested in two different seasons, the barley first and then the wheat immediately after that. And these two harvests correspond with the two feast seasons that we have, the days of unleavened bread for the barley, and then Pentecost corresponds to the wheat harvest. What does it take to harvest grain? Well, harvesting grain is actually a multi-step process Now, we don't really think about that too much, again, in our modern times, because all these processes are done pretty much at the same time. Our combines combine them all into one step. And with our modern equipment, on a good day, the farmers can easily harvest over 100 acres a day. But that's not the case when you're doing it by hand. So let's take a look at what the harvest process is. The first thing you had to do was you had to go in and cut the grain. So they would go in with hand sickles and they would start cutting the grain. But because it took a long time to do the cutting, the threshing, the winnowing, and everything, they couldn't wait until there were fields with amber waves of grain, like we do today. Because if they waited that long, by the time they got through with the process, they would lose too much grain in the field. So they would actually have to judge the barley so that they could tell when it reaches a certain point. Because once it reached that point, even after it's cut, the grains would still mature. And the way you can tell this is that the plants actually change color. They go from being green to taking on a white color. And Jesus referred to this. Let's take a look at that in John chapter 4 and verse 35. Talking about how you judge when to begin your harvest. You know, the situation here in John 4:35, Jesus was talking to the Samaritan woman. Disciples came back and, you know, they're like, wow, what's he doing talking with this Samaritan and woman? It's just untypical for men of Judea at the time. But what did he tell them? In John 4:35, he said, "Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest." That's what he's talking about. That's what the farmers would do. They would look at the fields, and once they get this white hue, this white color to them, they knew they could go in and start harvesting it. Because even after they cut the stalks, cut the plants, the grain would still mature. But they would look for the whiteness in the field to tell them when to start doing this. After the plants were cut, of course, now they're lying on the ground, people would have to come and follow along behind and start gathering up the plants. And they would put them together in sheaves. They would tie their sheaves together, and then they would stack them. Because remember, they're not really quite ripe yet. So they'd still stack them in the field, but they would stack them in a conical structure. That way, if the rain still came or if there was a heavy dew, the water would drain down into the field. And so that the grain heads weren't left in moisture so they wouldn't rot. And we see, again, a reference to this process of gathering things into sheaves back in Genesis 37. Genesis 37 and verse 7. This is where Joseph had his dreams. And so he's telling his brothers about it. Maybe not wisely so, but he did anyway. And what did he tell them? Here in Genesis 37, verse 7. "There we were, binding sheaves in the field, and then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." So here we see a reference to the process of gathering the cut stalks, binding them into sheaves, and then setting them up into the field. So as they continued to harvest the barley and the wheat later on, the sheaves would continue to mature out in the field. Once they were mature in the field, then they could be carried to the threshing floor. And the threshing is the next step. And what threshing accomplishes is that is the process by which we separate the grain from the stalks. Because you don't really need the stalks. You use it later on as straw, but you're trying to get the grain. That's the idea of the reason for planting it. So the mature grain sheaves were brought to the threshing floor. And the threshing floor, sometimes it's not necessarily, you think a floor like this. Very frequently it was just an area of dirt that had been leveled, packed down really hard and then swept so that as the threshing was done, that would help minimize the amount of dirt and stones that would then be in with the grain. So they'd bring the sheaves here and spread it out and lay it out. Now they had to get the grain away from the stalks. And there were various ways of doing this. One, they would have a heavy flail, kind of like a large flexible stick, and they would beat the grain with that. And that would cause the grain to separate from the stalks. We see a reference to that back here in Ruth, chapter 2 and verse 17. Ruth 2:17. So she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley. So yeah, you could use this flail to beat the grain out, but that is really hard work. And if you had a lot of grain, that's a lot of beating. And you just get worn out. So the primary method that was used is that they would use oxen to trample the stalks. You'd yoke your ox together, or even just one, and you'd have it go around and around, just walking over your grain. Because you think about it, the hooves, the oxen, they're hard, and they're actually fairly sharp. And you got all that beef that's weighing those hooves down. And so as the oxen would walk on the grain, that would separate the grain from the stalks. There's also a principle that was stated in the Old Testament, which Paul also referred to, that referred to the oxen trampling out the grain. Let's take a look at that in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verses 7 to 9. And the principle that Paul is saying here is, you know, those who do the work should be able to share in the benefits from it. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 7 through 9, Paul writes, "Whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses," and he got this from Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, "For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain." Is it oxen God is concerned about? So the oxen were used to trample the grain, to separate the grain from the seed heads and from the stalks. A third way that they would do would still make use of the oxen, so you get all the benefits of the hooves going over the grain. But in addition to that, they would have the oxen pull what's called a threshing sled. And these were planks that were put together, usually about 3 feet wide and about 6 feet long. And there would be holes in the planks, and they'd drive sharp stones through the holes. So now, as this sled is being dragged across the plants, it cuts them up and breaks them up so that it helps separate the grain from the plants. The Romans also had a version of this, and their word for it was the tribulum. And to give you an idea of the treatment that these sleds gave to the grain, tribulum comes from the same root word as our word tribulation. So it was a process which really broke up the grain, separated it from the stalks, and so forth. Once the grain was separated, it was only separated in the sense that it was no longer attached, because you still have this whole area filled with grain, filled with straw, filled with chaff. You need to get the grain out. And how are you going to do that? That's where the process of winnowing comes in. And winnowing is actually a very simple process. What they would do is they would use a winnowing fan, or sometimes it's called a winnowing fork. They would scoop into the grain and just toss it up in the air. But you can't do this just any old time. You have to have a wind. Because what happens is the wind is blowing. The grain is the heaviest component, so it's going to fall right back down. And then you have the straw, which is lighter, so the wind's going to blow it a little ways, and it falls down in an area over here. The chaff, which is nothing more than the seed hulls and stuff, is very light, and that wind is going to carry that completely away from the grain. So there's total separation. So you just keep going through this and going through this and, until you get almost all of the straw and the chaff winnowed out. Because of the way the climate was, you wouldn't necessarily have a whole lot of wind during the day. So it was in the evening time. That was primarily is when the winnowing was done. And again, let's take a look back in Ruth, chapter 3 and verse 2. In Ruth chapter 3 and verse 2, Naomi's talking to Ruth here, and she says, "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." It wasn't like he was putting in overtime, but that was the best time to do the winnowing, because you're almost always guaranteed of having a breeze in the evening. As the sun would go down, you'd have differences of energy and all the meteorological stuff there. You almost always were guaranteed to have a breeze. And that's the best time to do your winnowing. Finally, after the winnowing was done, they would still have to do sifting, because occasionally there were still stones in there. There might be a little bit of chaff or straw left in there. So the women would come in with these huge sifting baskets where they'd scoop it up, sort through it, and get rid of the stuff that wasn't needed. And again, we see a reference to that in Luke 22, verse 31. Luke 22, verse 31, Jesus is talking to Peter, and he says in verse 31, "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat." What was Satan asking to do? I mean, think about what the sifting process really is. You're picking it up, you're sorting through it, and deciding what you keep and what you get rid of. And of course, Satan wanted to sift through because he wanted to get rid of everyone who wanted to follow God. He would look for even the slightest flaw and say, "Oh, no, no good." So he wanted that permission. Good for us that Jesus did not give him that permission. So that is the process of harvesting grain. Cutting it, putting it in sheaves, threshing, winnowing, and then sifting. So this brings us to the barley harvest. The first month of the year, during the time of the unleavened bread, a lot of times it would continue into the second month. It would last about 30 days. Now, barley, it was used as a food source, but it wasn't really rated as well as what wheat. It just wasn't valued as highly. In fact, a lot of times it was used as feed for the livestock. Turn back to 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 28. See, they didn't have oats. They didn't really have rye or things like that, which we would typically feed to our livestock today. So they had to have something that they fed to the livestock. And here in 1 Kings 4:28, we see that that is one of the things that they did with the barley. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. So barley was used as feed for livestock. But it was also used as the primary grain source for the poorer segments of society. Because barley wasn't valued as highly as wheat, therefore it didn't cost as much. In fact, there are some times, as we can see in the Bible, that barley only cost half the amount that wheat did. Turn over to 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 7 and verse 1, also 16 and 18, but we'll only read verse 1. "And Elisha said, Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, Tomorrow at this time, a seah of fine flour," which is the wheat, "a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and two seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." So we see that barley was not valued as highly as what wheat was. So the barley harvest would continue, last for about 30 days, and because of the nature of the maturity times of barley and wheat, as soon as they were done with the barley, they would then start in with the wheat harvest. And again, this corresponds to about the time of Pentecost. But another very critical thing takes place during this time period. During the 7 weeks between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost, the prevailing winds start to shift. Instead of coming over the Mediterranean, they now start to shift and come over from the east part of Israel. And what's over there? Deserts. So there is no moisture. So before they even start harvesting the wheat, the rain stops. And it doesn't start up again until late October, early November. 6 months, no rain. So when you're harvesting wheat, you don't expect to see rain. So when it does rain, you know something is wrong. And we see an example of that in 1 Samuel chapter 12 and 16 through 18. What's happened here in 1 Samuel chapter 12, 16 to 18? The Israelites had come to Samuel and said, "Give us a king." And Samuel went to God and talked to him about it and was not pleased, but came back to the Israelites. And look what he told them. 1 Samuel 12, 16 to 18. "Now therefore, stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Lord, and he will send thunder and rain, that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord, in asking for a king for yourselves." So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. It's not just another ordinary rain shower. It doesn't rain when we're harvesting wheat. And suddenly, because God controls the rain, there's this thunderstorm and rain during the wheat harvest, and they knew. They knew they had displeased God. But without understanding the agricultural year, you wouldn't necessarily understand the magnitude of how they knew that they had displeased God here, because it doesn't rain during the wheat harvest. Finally, after the wheat is harvested, we're into the dry season, and starting in the summer, we have the fruit harvest. Fruit harvest usually starts in the fifth month and continues through the seventh month. And the major fruits that are harvested are grapes, which they then press into wine, dates, figs, pomegranates, and finally, the olives, which they would press into oil. The overall fruit harvest was significantly larger and greater volume than what the grain harvest was. And it was this fruit harvest which is what led up to the Feast of Ingathering in the seventh month, the Feast of Tabernacles, Leviticus 23, verse 39. Leviticus 23, 39. "Also, on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. On the first day there should be a Sabbath rest, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest." So the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Ingathering, corresponding to the harvest of all these different fruits. And it was a huge, exceeding harvest. I don't have time to go into all the different analogies that are throughout the Bible that reference different aspects of the agricultural year. But as we read and we study that, having a better understanding of what does happen over the period of the year can help us to have a better understanding of what God means, what he's trying to teach us, and the significance of what is being said. Because the Bible makes numerous references to farming, and there's a lot of symbolic meaning to the feasts, to the parables that Jesus uses, to the analogies that are used within his pages. For example, God's word is depicted as rainfall and as the seed being planted. The church is referred to as the first fruits. And there are a lot of other examples throughout the pages of the Bible. So what I wanted to do today was to help us understand better this farming year, so that as we read and as we study these things, we can get a better understanding of what we need to learn from the examples that the Bible gives us.